Peter M. Sandman gives an annual lecture via Zoom to Professor Michael Osterholm's University of Minnesota graduate course on emerging infectious diseases, current issues, policies, and controversies. This year's 62-minute presentation on February 10, 2025, was his usual summary of the basics of his approach to risk communication, with special reference to the COVID pandemic and occasional mentions of a possible bird flu pandemic. At the start, Dr. Sandman spends a few minutes talking about two other topics, public health dishonesty and how public health professionals might best respond to the challenges of the Trump presidency.
In the business, I've learned a lot about communication, still have a lot more to learn, and I'm working on that. And the business of risk communication in particular is a real challenge. And no one has done it better. No one has defined the science of all of this issue more than Peter has. It's been remarkable what he has done over his career, and I feel very blessed to have kind of served as almost one of his students. And really learned a lot from him. Today, he's going to share with us what I think you'll find to be intriguing, compelling, and at times challenging information about the topic area itself. And there's no one better to do it than him. And so I really look forward to also after the lecture taking a break. We'll break for about 10 to 15 minutes, decided where we're at, and then we'll come back and do Q&A from there. So welcome, everyone. Peter, suffice it to say, I've already shared my point of view about you. It's a real gift to have him, to be able to do this. He's coming to us live from Guatemala today. That's a wonderful place to be right now, but we're glad he's talking to us here in Minneapolis, St. Paul. So with that, I'll turn it back over. Angie or Corey, anything you want to add before we start?
No, okay. But it's great to have you back, Peter. Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
Okay, Corey, I'm going to put the slides up, and then we'll let Peter go to town. And again, thank you so much, Peter, for being here with us.
Okay, thank you. The title notwithstanding, this is going to be mostly a generic presentation on risk communication, or at least my approach to risk communication. There will be some COVID applications and maybe some H5N1 applications, particularly if I get that far in the last slide. But if you want more on my approach to COVID in particular, or my thinking about H5N1, not mostly current, but back when we were worried about H5N1 first time around, there's a lot on my website about both of those issues. What is not going to be a focus today, although it was a focus of the readings, is the issue of dishonesty in public health. I will say with regard to the readings that, for years, I predicted that public health dishonesty would lead to a loss of trust. And I was wrong until I was right. It really wasn't until COVID that the loss of trust that I had long predicted seemed to happen. Even I hadn't predicted that it would be as polarized as it was, that it would be a loss of trust, particularly on the right, and much less so on the left. Nor did I predict that the loss of trust would wind up in the right taking over, which is what we're all facing now. And I'm not going to address that either, unless it comes up in the Q&A, but I felt like it's the elephant in the room, and I should take at least a minute or two to say some thoughts about public health with Donald Trump in the White House. And the first thing I'll say is I urge you all not to let that hijack your education. And I urge people in public health to not let it hijack their focus, that the basics of public health haven't changed. The basics of risk communication in public health haven't changed. And an excessive focus on the very short-term challenges that the Trump White House presents might very well be a mistake. I also want to point out a few other things. I think it's worth noting that what is happening to public health now is largely a reaction to errors that public health made, particularly in COVID. And I think it's really important to think this did not come out of left field, or in this case, I guess, out of right field. It is a response to things that that public health did. And I think public health often gets the causality backwards. Public health people tend to say the public doesn't trust us because it's listening to outsiders. And I think it's much more the case that the public is listening to outsiders because it has learned not to trust the mainstream. And earning back trust, it seems to me, is certainly the long-term goal, and maybe even the short-term goal, rather than blaming the people who are mobilizing that distrust. There needs to be a focus on earning back the trust. I also want to point out that White House control of public health is nothing new. I grant that it's being done wholesale rather than retail, maybe, or certainly in a way that's less subtle than we're used to. But it's worth remembering that President Biden made the CDC pretend that the pandemic was a reason to tell tenants they don't have to pay their rent. I think it's worth remembering that President Obama made the CDC pretend that Zika was a big deal in the continental United States. Under Obama's behest, they produced mosquito maps that overstated the Zika problem. They put Puerto Rico, where it was a big problem, in the same category as Florida and Texas to make it look like it was a big problem in Florida and Texas. And this was all at the behest of the Obama White House. So granted, it's being done more aggressively and more extensively now, but knuckling under to the White House is not something new for public health. I would urge public health people to restrain their own outrage. And in a minute, I'm going to be talking about outrage. As I look at the public health response to the last 3 weeks, it's a little bit like the neighbors of a factory who are responding to this odious factory's emissions and assuming and claiming that the emissions are deadly, even when they're not. And I think we need to distinguish White House offenses that are deadly from White House offenses that are merely offensive and that are speaking more to our outrage than to any meaningful hazard to public health. I would note that keep fighting is the wrong message. Keep doing public health is the right message. That may mean sometimes fighting, but I would urge everyone to look at a Venn diagram where what's worth doing in public health is one circle, and what the Trump administration wants to do is another circle. And let's focus some on the intersection. Because I think there are some things that Trump wants to do that public health also wants to do. And now is a propitious time to focus on those things rather than focusing on the things that the Trump administration is less enthusiastic about. Last comment, and then I'll go on to what I was supposed to talk about. Think about democracy and think about expertocracy. And can take seriously the possibility that a diminished power of experts and an increased power of the public is not necessarily entirely a bad thing for the country. I think checks and balances are still in place. The courts are still there. Congress, hopefully, is still there and capable of exercising some influence. And above all, the midterms are coming in 2 years. And in 2 years, the public will have a chance to decide whether what it has experienced in the previous 2 years is something it wants to continue or something it wants to restrain. All of those are at least beginning thoughts. I think this is indisputably a hard time for public health, but it's perhaps not as awful a time as some of what I've been reading in public health wants to claim it is. That's all I want to say, just to get the elephant in the room out of the room. And if we want to come back to that in the Q&A, I'm happy to do so. So let's go to the first real slide, please. This is the traditional definition of risk. It's very straightforward. It's a multiplication of two things, magnitude times probability. How bad is in it? You get your best measure of how bad it is, your best measure of how likely it is. You multiply them by each other, and you come up with something like expected annual mortality. And I did my original work with engineers, and this is what engineers mean by risk. How bad is it times how likely is it? And as I started doing this work in the 1980s, I began to realize that there was something wrong with that definition. So I started trying to come up with a new definition of risk. Next slide, please. And I coined the formula sent my children to college, and I think is going to send my grandchildren to college. Next slide, please. And it starts with the idea that risk is made up of two components, the hazard and the outrage. The hazard is what risk assessors mean by risk, magnitude times probability. And the outrage is what ordinary people mean by risk. Before I go any further, I have to tell you the word outrage is problematic. It was working just fine on environmental controversies, which is where I coined the term. It's a mixture of anger and fear and self-righteousness. It's what factory neighbors feel about the emissions of the factory. The term doesn't work as well for pandemics, say, where what I'm calling outrage is largely misery. It doesn't work for a lot of crises where it's almost entirely fear. In policy fights, it might be almost entirely anger. But it's my jargon and I'm stuck with it. I think the best way to think about what I mean by outrage is how upset you are, how emotionally outraged you are. And in that context, next slide, please. In that context, I coined the formula risk is equal to hazard plus outrage. I didn't actually mean the plus sign literally when I coined this formula back in the 1980s. Invariably, when I was giving this presentation, I would hear engineers muttering to each other, "That's what happens when you let a humanities major write a formula." So I came up with an alternative version of the formula that engineers like much better. Next slide, please. Risk is a function of hazard and outrage. That's hazard plus outrage in their code. Now this slide is in some ways the core of what I want to talk about, so I'm going to stay with it for a couple of minutes. The core problem in risk communication is the very low correlation between hazard and outrage. That is, between how dangerous something is and how upsetting it is. That correlation hovers around 0.2. If you have taken a statistics class, you may remember you can square a correlation coefficient to get the percentage of variance accounted for. If you square 0.2, you get a glorious 4% of the variance. Or, and here it is without numbers, if you know a risk is dangerous, that tells you almost nothing about whether it's upsetting. If you know it's upsetting, that tells you almost nothing about whether it's dangerous. There's very little relationship between those two variables. But, and this is an important but, there is a strong correlation between outrage and perceived hazard. That correlation is around 0.7. You square that, you get 0.49, so, accounting for about half the variance. So there's a good, strong correlation between outrage and perceived hazard. Okay, now, whenever you have a strong correlation, the question you ask yourself is, what's the causal structure of that correlation? So the question we're asking is, are people upset because they think it's dangerous? Or do people think it's dangerous because they're upset? Now, that's a very important question. If you want to manage something, you have to know what's cause and what's effect. If they're upset because they think it's dangerous, then if it's not dangerous, you should tell them it's not dangerous, and then they'll calm down. If, on the other hand, they think it's dangerous because they're upset, then if you want them to, then you have to stop upsetting them. And then only after you stop upsetting them are they capable of learning that it's not dangerous. So you need to know what's cause and what's effect. And there's been a lot of research on this. And the research suggests that it's a cycle. There are arrows in both directions. But the arrow from outrage to perceived hazard is very strong. And the arrow from perceived hazard to outrage is quite weak. It's there, but it's surprisingly weak. So for the most part, it is not true that people are upset because they think something is dangerous. It's much more true that people think something is dangerous because they're upset. Okay? Outrage is the engine of hazard perception. Hazard perception is not the engine of outrage. Okay? And off in the corner, we have actual hazard, which isn't the engine of anything. Now, I'm not suggesting that hazard isn't important. Obviously, if you're in public health, hazard is incredibly important. You very much want to manage whether people die. You want to manage whether people get sick. But it has very little effect on hazard perception, and it has very little effect on outrage. It's off in a corner by itself. Whereas outrage and hazard perception are yoked at the hip, and outrage is mostly the cause, and hazard perception is mostly the result, okay? And that turns out to be, in my judgment, absolutely at the core of what risk communication is all about, okay? Risk communication, in my judgment, is managing outrage in order to influence hazard perception. Okay. All right. So in order to put some meat on those bones, next slide, please. What I want to do is graph hazard against outrage. And remember, there's a 0.2 correlation between hazard and outrage. So all four corners of this graph are occupied. And what I want to do is locate the various paradigms of risk communication, the various kinds of risk communication on this graph. Next slide, please. We will start down in the lower right-hand corner with risks that are high hazard, low outrage. People are endangered, but not very upset. They are insufficiently upset. Okay. And this is the venue of what I call precaution advocacy. The task is to warn people. This is what we do in health communication. It's what we do in safety communication. The essence of the paradigm is watch out. Okay, we're trying to get people to take precautions. Next slide, please. And as that suggests, since the essence of risk communication is to manage the outrage in order to manage the hazard perception, this arrow becomes the core of precaution advocacy. The essence of precaution advocacy is to increase people's outrage. Not for the hell of it. Not for the fun of it. You want to increase the outrage in order to increase their hazard perception, in order to get them to take or tolerate or advocate precautions. Okay. So that arrow is because you understand the causal structure of risk communication. You understand that outrage leads to hazard perception, so you are trying to increase the outrage in order to increase the hazard perception, in order to get people to take or tolerate or demand precautions. Now, it turns out that precaution advocacy is quite a challenge in public health. And the main reason it's a challenge is because a definition for low outrage, or a synonym for low outrage, is apathy. If outrage is very low, interest is very low, and it's therefore very hard to get and keep people's attention. So some of the very basic principles of outrage, I'm sorry, of precaution advocacy, you have to keep your message short. You have to repeat it a lot. You have to keep it simple. You have to make it interesting. And you try, to the extent that you can, to motivate information seeking, to arouse outrage, or arouse fear, or arouse anger, or arouse some other kind of outrage, appeal perhaps to existing outrage, appeal to needs. The what is often called the foot in the door strategy, or cognitive dissonance strategy, is very important in precaution advocacy. You get people to make an initial behavior that becomes a behavioral commitment, and then you tell them, if you did that, it must be because you're concerned. And if you're concerned, then you ought to do some of these other things as well. Precaution advocacy is a well-developed field. And I think there are lots of public health practitioners who are good at precaution advocacy. When they're bad at it, and they are sometimes bad at it, it's usually because they forget the direction of the causality. And they imagine that if they can convince people that it's dangerous, then they will get upset. And as I've tried to suggest to you, that gets it exactly backwards. Educating people in order to get them to take precautions works not very well. Whereas if you can mobilize outrage, if you can arouse outrage, they will educate themselves and take precautions. So outrage is much more the engine of precaution advocacy than education is. Next slide, please. Some of the implications of precaution advocacy for pandemics. Obviously, it's crucial, especially crucial early in a pandemic. In the early months of COVID, when we really needed to get people upset about COVID, unfortunately, a lot of public health was trying to calm people down. Instead of trying to get people upset, so that they had the entirely the wrong model of where they were on this map of hazard versus outrage. I would say precaution advocacy is also important pre-pandemic. So as we think about H5N1 bird flu now, There is not a pandemic, at least as of yesterday. But a lot of people are worried. A lot of virologists are worried, and public health people are worried that a bird flu pandemic might be coming in the next months or next years. If you want people to start paying attention, then you are doing precaution advocacy about H5N1. It's also important, I think, when people overestimate good news. You may remember in the relatively early days of the COVID pandemic, after when we thought vaccination means you can't get infected, which was true before Omicron, or largely true before Omicron. So people got vaccinated, and then they calmed down and they stopped worrying. So there was a need for precaution advocacy all over again, saying, no, we were wrong about that. And as you all know, public health has a very hard time saying we were wrong ever. But there was a real need to say, we told you, if you're vaccinated, you don't have to worry. It's a pandemic of the unvaccinated. Okay, we got that wrong. And you've been vaccinated, or you've been infected already, and you still have to worry. So that was a need for precaution advocacy. I should alert you to the fact that people get sick of precaution advocacy. It's called warning fatigue, and it's a real phenomenon. And it happened vis-a-vis COVID. People started resenting the warnings. It's not that they weren't at risk anymore. They were just sick and tired of being told that they were at risk. Maybe you need to ration your warnings, or escalate your warnings, or vary your warnings, or at least acknowledge to people, I know you're sick of hearing this, but even though we're sick of the pandemic, even though we're done with the pandemic is not done with us. I think warning fatigue is a consistent problem in precaution advocacy. Lots more I could say about precaution advocacy, but in the interest of time, if you're interested in more about any of what I'm saying in this presentation, go to my website, which has enormously more than any normal human being would want to read about each of these paradigms. But that's all I'm going to say today about precaution advocacy. Next slide, please. In the opposite corner, we have outrage management. These are the risks that are high in outrage and low in hazard. People are upset but not endangered. So of course you want to calm them down. You want them, and you want them less upset. And again, the causality is crucial. You want them less upset so that they will have a lower hazard perception, so they will stop taking precautions or demanding precautions that you consider unwise. So, in other words, next slide, please. The essence of outrage management is the downward arrow. And once again, teaching people that the hazard is low doesn't work very well, because outrage is the engine of hazard perception. Hazard perception is not the engine of outrage. So just as in precaution advocacy, you had to get people more outraged, in outrage management, you need to get them less outraged. This is probably the most difficult task in public health. It's hard enough to arouse outrage, but once we understand that we need to arouse outrage when people are apathetic, we can figure out how to do it. Calming people down is profoundly counterintuitive. And I should, by the way, say, look, I keep saying calming people down. That's the paradigm, but that's not the message. Right? Because calm down doesn't work. When you say people calm down, especially if your tone suggests that what you're really saying is calm down, you hysterical idiot. That's not a useful message. So you almost never have occasion to say calm down, even though calming them down is your goal. So what are some of the things you do in outrage management? And again, I'm not going to have anything like enough time to cover this in detail, but I want to give you a sense of the flavor of outrage management and how different it is from precaution advocacy. One of the things you do is you stake out the middle rather than the extreme. If you say perfectly safe, it's going to backfire. In an argument between perfectly safe and incredibly dangerous, incredibly dangerous wins. But in an argument between perfectly safe and moderately safe, I'm sorry, between moderately safe and incredibly dangerous, that's what I meant to say, moderately safe stands a good chance of winning. So you have to stake out the middle. You have to acknowledge your misbehaviors and your mistakes. You have to acknowledge your current problems. You have to give away the credit when people are outraged that they keep demanding things. And my clients used to give in to those demands and then pretend that they didn't. They would do something that their outraged stakeholders were demanding, and then they would say, "Has nothing to do with your demands. We were going to do that anyway." Which is essentially pissing away the outrage management value of the concession that they were already making. So if you're doing things people want you to do, give them credit for making you do them. Sharing control is an important strategy of outrage management. If you can't share control, being accountable. Okay. There's also, I think, a process of outrage management, and when people are outraged, the thing they most want to do before you do anything is yell at you how outraged they are. So I spend a lot of time advising clients on how to deal with public meetings of outraged stakeholders, and I would say, okay, start by listening while they vent. That's step one. Okay. And you keep listening until they get sick of venting. And eventually they will turn to you and say, "Well, what have you got to say? Well, you've been listening for 3 hours. What's your response to everything we've said?" And then it's your opportunity to echo. Okay. Let me see if I understand what you're telling me. Basically, after they're done telling you what a jerk they think you are, you get to tell them what a jerk they think you are. So you echo their complaints. Third step is you find something to agree with. And if you can't agree with something about the hazard, you can almost always agree with something about the outrage. If you can't agree that, yes, vaccines are really every bit as dangerous as you guys are claiming they are, you can't agree with that because it's not true. You can probably agree, yes, we were less than transparent about the results of our vaccine safety studies. You can find an outrage, issue with which you can agree with them. And make that agreement as dramatic as you can. Don't just agree with the outrage, but ally with the outrage. Find the most outraged person in the room and ally with that person so that everybody else in the room is thinking, "God, you're being, much more gentle with that person than I would be. Susan is being a jerk and you're allying with Susan," and they're all rolling their eyes. And that's great. If you can get, Susan's allies to roll their eyes 'cause Susan's being a jerk and you're not telling her so, you're way ahead of the game. And eventually, of course, you're going to have to disagree. If there are things they're wrong about, you eventually need to get to explaining to them the things you think they're wrong about. As I'm trying to emphasize, that comes late in the process of outrage management. Next slide, please. Outrage management does indeed play a role in pandemics. The example that's most obvious is vaccination. Vaccine hesitant people who are fearful of the possible side effects, or they're mistrustful of the experts that are telling them that this vaccine is safe. And it's important, you know, not just with regard to vaccines, but more generally, it's important to diagnose when you're dealing with people who are too apathetic about the hazard, and when you're dealing with people who are too outraged about the remedy. You know, so in COVID, and this is going to be true if there's an H5N1 pandemic as well, in COVID, there are some people who aren't taking precautions, and their problem is they're not upset enough about the virus. But there are other people who aren't taking precautions because they are upset about the precaution. It might be the vaccine or lockdowns or masks. It might be the nanny state that's interfering with my personal autonomy. It might be that public health is prioritizing health over everything else. The agencies are being too authoritarian. They are censoring the outliers. They are contemptuous. They are dishonest. All the things that people might be thinking about public health that's not about the virus. It's about outrage at things you are doing, or outrage at precautions, things you're urging them to do. So I think, you know, one of the things that was definitely true in COVID and will be true, I think, if we have another pandemic, is there was much too little outrage management. There was much too much focus on precaution advocacy about the virus, and much too little focus on outrage management about the precautions and agency authoritarianism, et cetera. Ditto for political polarization, of course. And of course, you know, as a pandemic winds down, and, you know, I mean, I think we can all agree that COVID is not as deadly as it was a couple of years ago, then you have an outrage management with problem with regard to the remnant of people who are stuck in the precautions they were taking at the apex of the pandemic. You know, people who are, I won't say still wearing masks, but still wearing masks all the time, going back even further in time, they are still sanitizing their mail. You know, and fomites was never a big problem with COVID. So, you know, there may be opportunities or even needs for outrage management there. It's worth noticing generically that very often in a controversy, one side is doing precaution advocacy while the other side is doing outrage management. You know, so that I did a lot of work with corporations back in the day with corporate controversies. And it's absolutely typical that the activists are doing precaution advocacy and the company is doing outrage management. So the company is saying to the stakeholders, you're much more upset about these emissions than they deserve. And the activists are saying, you're not nearly upset enough. Get more upset about these emissions. So the activists are looking for components of outrage to mobilize. And the company is looking for ways to diminish those components of outrage. So that's more normal than not. Next slide, please. Very quickly, just to put a little bit of meat on the bones, this slide and the next are the principal components of outrage. If a risk is voluntary, natural, familiar, not memorable, not dreaded, chronic, I'm going to have six more on the next slide, I'm going to think it's safe even if it kills me. If it's coerced, industrial, exotic, memorable, dreaded, and catastrophic, I'm going to think it's dangerous, even if it's not very dangerous. So these are the components of outrage, and they are therefore the components of hazard perception. Because outrage determines hazard perception in large measure. So if you're trying to get people more outraged, you want to look at, and I'll get to the other six in a minute. You want to look at your list of 12 principal components of outrage and say, which of these can I mobilize? Which of these can I remind people of in order to exacerbate the outrage? Can I say this is coerced? How dare they coerce you into wearing a mask? If I want to mobilize outrage about masks, if I want to diminish outrage, then I want to try to diminish the sources of outrage. So I want to make it less coerced, or at least make people less sensitive to the coercion. So for each of these six, and for the other six I'll get to in a minute, what you want to do is figure out which are the 800-pound gorillas, which are the ones that are dominating the outrage or capable of dominating the outrage, and then mobilize them up if you're doing precaution advocacy, and mobilize them down if you're doing outrage management. Next slide, please. These are the other six. If it's knowable and individually controlled and fair and morally irrelevant and the sources are trustworthy and the process is responsive, I am going to feel safe, independent of the hazard. If it's unknowable, a lot of uncertainty, a lot of expert disagreement, it's controlled by others, it's not fair, it's morally relevant, it's not just harmful, it's evil. The sources can't be trusted, the process is unresponsive, all of those things are going to make my outrage higher. Now, if we had all the time in the world, we could do an outrage assessment of COVID, and then we could do an outrage assessment of lockdown. And you would very quickly see that lockdown is easier to generate outrage about than COVID. Which was a problem. You know, if you want people to lock down and, you know, you've got a remedy that in hazard terms is maybe a pretty, pretty effective remedy. I know that's debatable. But you're convinced that lockdown is a good idea. It's a high outrage hazard reducer. And if you're going to sell lockdown, you have to sell it knowing it's high hazard. I'm sorry, it's high outrage. It's higher outrage than the virus. And that's going to make it a very difficult piece of risk communication to accomplish, as indeed it turned out to be. Okay, enough on outrage management. And again, if you want more on outrage management or more on precaution advocacy, look at my website. There are separate indexes for everything I've written about precaution advocacy, everything I've written about outrage management. But I'm going to go on to the third of the paradigms. Next slide, please. And here we are in the upper right-hand corner. High hazard, high outrage. This is the third paradigm, crisis communication. People are upset, and they're right to be upset because they are genuinely endangered. Next slide, please. No arrow. Okay. The goal of risk communication with regard to precaution advocacy and outrage management is to get the outrage commensurate with the hazard. The problem in precaution advocacy is there's too little hazard. I'm sorry, there's too little outrage. So you want to get it higher so that it's, commensurate with the hazard. The problem with outrage management is there's too much outrage. You want to get it lower so that it's commensurate with the hazard. In crisis communication, it's already commensurate with the hazard. So there's no arrow. You got no need to get people upset. They're already upset. And you've got no business trying to calm them down. Because being upset is useful in a crisis. It's what mobilizes people to take precautions. But there's still risk communication to be done. You need to validate their outrage. You need to help them bear their outrage and help them bear the hazard. You need to help them make wise rather than unwise decisions about which precautions to take. Okay, so that, there's still risk communication to be done, and the crisis communication toolkit is a third toolkit. It's different from the toolkit for precaution advocacy. It's different from the toolkit for outrage management. I'm going to get in a minute to some of the key crisis communication strategies for a pandemic. But first, next slide, please. Let's look at some of the ways that crisis communication is needed in a pandemic. And I think this is obvious, but I need to say it. This is the main task in a pandemic. Right. I mean, I went out of my way to say there's a need for precaution advocacy sometimes. There's a need for outrage management sometimes. But, you know, when people are dropping dead, they're usually upset and endangered. And you don't have to tell them to get upset. The pandemic is getting them upset. So the crisis communication is the meat and potatoes in a pandemic. I don't want to overstate that. You know, I'm not backing off of my claim that there was a need early on for precaution advocacy. There was a need for outrage management about the remedies, about the precautions you were advocating. But crisis communication is the main task, it seems to me, in a pandemic, because a pandemic is a crisis. So let me list some of the strategies that are in the crisis communication toolkit. Next slide, please. I have a list of, Jody and I developed a list of 25 crisis communication strategies, and you can find that on the website. But I'm going to just focus on just some of them here. Don't over reassure. You're better off erring on the alarming side. You can get away with being too scary. If you over reassure, you're going to reap the whirlwind. Acknowledge uncertainty. This is one that was done very badly, it seems to me, with regard to COVID. There was a tendency, even with regard to conclusions that turned out right, there was the tendency to be overconfident before we knew they were right. And as you all know, some of them turned out wrong. And you know, one of the downsides of overstating your confidence is it becomes harder to acknowledge that you were wrong. So, you know, in many cases, with regard to herd immunity, for example, public health went from overconfidently stating what they genuinely believed to lying about it because they realized it wasn't true and they didn't want to back off because they'd been overconfident in the first place. So an overconfident mistake often, you know, leads to dishonesty down the road because it's so difficult to admit the mistake. Share dilemmas, you know, the problems. We can't decide whether to do this or do that. And, you know, we're damned if we do and damned if we don't, or we're damned if we do and darned if we don't, but it's still a dilemma. Don't fake consensus. That's another one that went very badly awry, it seemed to me, during the pandemic. You know, a lot of the people that Donald Trump is appointing to high positions in public health are people who were outliers during the pandemic, who expressed opinions that were not the mainstream opinion. And instead of there being respectful debate, they were deplatformed, they were censored, there was a manufactured consensus. In punishment for your sins, they're now going to be in charge of your agency. I think we, you know, it's important to understand how that happened. Be willing to speculate. You know, the fact that you have to acknowledge uncertainty doesn't mean you have to shut up until you're certain. You know, the public health needs to learn, and especially in a crisis, to say things that might be wrong and to say that they might be wrong. You know, so far we think X, but we may turn out wrong. We're going to act on the assumption that X is right, but we're going to keep our mind open because if it turns out that X is wrong, we will change our policy. So you got to combine acknowledging uncertainty with being willing to speculate. Validate people's outrage, their fear, their misery, their other emotions. Establish your own humanity. Next slide, please. Some more of these. Tell people what to expect. Offer people things to do. Give them ways of keeping busy. People are better able to bear the high outrage of a crisis if they have an agenda of things to do and choices of things to do. Acknowledge and apologize for errors, deficiencies, and misbehaviors. This was another one that was, I thought, very badly handled in the pandemic, as I already said. It's inevitable that you make mistakes. It's not inevitable that you hang on to your mistakes and refuse to own them. And much of the time, public health refused to own its mistakes. And long after they knew better, the World Health Organization was still insisting that COVID is not airborne. When they started insisting that COVID is not airborne, they were only overconfident. But by the end, they were dishonest and refusing to acknowledge a mistake that they already knew they were making. Be explicit about changes in official predictions and opinions and policies. Don't lie and don't tell half truths. Aim for total candor. And I dealt aggressively with that, I think, in the readings, so I won't say more about it now. I think that's all I'm going to say about crisis communication. Next slide. Okay, this is the map. Down in the bottom, in the lower left-hand corner, I do not have a circle. That's because I didn't find it when I was in business. I'm retired now, but I never found that to be a profit center. I earned money doing precaution advocacy and crisis communication and outrage management. I should note in passing that outrage management pays way better than the other two. For reasons that are, we can explore in the Q&A if you're interested. But down in the lower left-hand corner, low hazard, low outrage, there's no risk communication to be done. What would you say to people? Congratulations on your apathy. You're absolutely right. This is trivial. If people aren't worried about something and shouldn't be worried about it, there's very little reason to talk about it. But if they're only temporarily in the lower left-hand corner, that's a different story. So if you think they're going to be outraged, you might want to do some pre-outrage management. If you think they're going to be endangered, the hurricane is a week away, but it's coming, then you want to do some pre-precaution advocacy. And of course, if you think both are going to happen, that is the venue for the opportunity for pre-crisis communication. This map, and this is right what you have in front of you, is the risk communication map, at least in my judgment. But it's a snapshot. It's at a specific time. So you figure out how much hazard there is now and how much outrage there is now. And that tells you where you are on the map now. But you also want to think about how much hazard there's going to be and how much outrage there's going to be and where you might get to on the map. And there are patterns here. The most common pattern is early on you're doing precaution advocacy, then the crisis, people get appropriately upset, the hazard becomes clearer, and you're doing crisis communication. And then after the crisis has passed and they're angry at you for not having done a better job of protecting them, you're doing outrage management. So there's a very common sequence from precaution advocacy to crisis communication to outrage management. But the generic point here is this is a snapshot, and you have to keep asking yourself, where am I now? I might not be where I was a month ago. It is also a snapshot that's particular to who you're talking about. So, corporations are very often doing precaution advocacy with their employees to use their safety gear at exactly the same time on exactly the same risk that they're doing outrage management with their neighbors. They're telling their neighbors, don't worry about the emissions, and they're telling their employees, for God's sake, put on your mask. Because the employees have a higher hazard, and so out it's a precaution advocacy for the employees, it's outrage management for the neighborhood. So it's a question of who you are. Activists are doing outrage manage are doing precaution advocacy while the company is doing outrage management. It's a question of who they are. The company is doing precaution advocacy for its employees, but outrage management for its neighbors. And it's a question of when. Okay, so this is the right map, but it's a narrow map for a particular set of stakeholders and a particular you at a particular time. Next slide, please. Right in the middle of the map, we have what I have usually called the sweet spot. You might call that the stakeholder engagement part of the map, or the public participation part of the map. Hazard is moderately high, but not too high. Outrage is moderately high, but not too high. This is where data get communicated the most. Okay. In precaution advocacy, people aren't interested enough to pay attention to a lot of data. In outrage management, they're too angry at you to pay attention to your data. They don't believe your data. In crisis communication, you haven't got time to talk about data. You have to evacuate or whatever. But in the sweet spot, it's you and your stakeholders sitting around comfortably talking about the data. I didn't do a lot of work in the sweet spot. It's a real kind of risk communication, but it's easy. And nobody needed a high-priced risk communication consultant to learn how to chat about data. So that it was never my field, but it is a field. And there's an organization called IAP2, the International Association for Public Participation, which is dedicated to how you do good communication in what I call the sweet spot. My warning to public health people is the sweet spot is seductive. It's by far the easiest location on the map. Precaution advocacy is hard because people are apathetic. Outrage management is hard because people are upset. Crisis communication is hard because people are dying and upset. The sweet spot is easy and fun. It's worth doing, but don't neglect the three corners. Don't get stuck in the sweet spot. But the generic message here, and I'm sort of winding up, the generic message here is diagnose where you are on the map and then deploy the right toolkit. There is a precaution advocacy toolkit. There is an outrage management toolkit. There's a crisis communication toolkit. They are not the same. So you have to figure out where you are and where you're going and what toolkit you need. There's also a public participation toolkit for the sweet spot. And you won't find that one on my website. Go to IAP2, and you'll find it on their website. Next slide, please. Yes, there's a role for the sweet spot in the pandemic, explaining your policies and your recommendations and their rationales to journalists. That's in the sweet spot. Gathering experts to identify areas of consensus and dissensus. A respectful a debate over policy belongs in the sweet spot. If experts start getting angry at each other, then you're in outrage management land. But if experts are respectful of each other, you're in the sweet spot. So there is real stuff to be done in the sweet spot. Next slide, please. This is just a summary of the four paradigms. Precaution advocacy, the paradigm is watch out. The hazard is high, the outrage is low. In outrage management, the paradigm is calm down. The message is not calm down because that is not a calming message. But the outrage is too high. You're trying to calm them down. In crisis communication, the message is we'll get through this together. You're allying with your endangered and outraged stakeholders and helping them bear how upsetting the situation is and helping them figure out what precautions are wise and what precautions are not wise. In the sweet spot, the paradigm is let's sit down and figure this out together. It's a much calmer than crisis communication. You and them chatting comfortably about the risk. That's the sort of summary slide. Next slide, please. And this is the last slide. When I put this together, these were my top of mind gripes about COVID risk communication. And a lot of them I've already covered now. They public health professionals too often discouraged and disparaged dissenting expert opinion, too often sounded overconfident and resisted acknowledging their own ignorance and uncertainty, too often prioritized health over truth, telling people what you want them to think in order to get them to do what you want them to do, instead of telling them what you know, and letting the chips fall where they may. Public health professionals too often prioritized health over other values, economic well-being, psychological well-being, freedom, education, all kinds of other values that need to be compromised with mortality and morbidity. Public health professionals too often conflated their policy opinions with the science. The science is what you found. What you think ought to be done about what you found is not the science. It's a policy opinion, and you shouldn't be pulling rank as an expert about your policy opinions. Public health professionals too seldom acknowledged and apologized for things they got wrong. Public health professionals too often supported censorship, conflating opinions they considered unwise with misinformation. And as punishment for your sins, the misinformation people are now in charge. And finally, public health professionals have contributed and keep contributing to the politicization of public health. It's demonstrably, empirically true that most people in public health are on the left, and just like it's true that most people in public health are white, the difference is people in public health have made a real effort to do outrage to people of color. They have not made a comparable effort to do outrage to people on the political right. So that the politicization, where we are, now reaping the whirlwind is something we contributed to. It's not something that was done to us. And I think I'm going to stop there. Mike, you wanted you
Yeah.
I have no idea how much time I took, but you
Oh,
want to take a break and then we'll do
yeah, you did
Q&A?
it in blinding speed. It's 11:14. So why don't we go ahead and take a 10-minute break? Let's start again at 11:25, okay? And then we'll come
Done.
back. And Peter, that was outstanding. Thank you. I look forward to the discussions.